today, how America's opioid epidemic destroyed the lives of people living in a rural corner of West Virginia. And Emma Barnett on why we all need to talk about periods.
Once you've found the right doctor and have told him or her about your pain, don't be afraid to take what they give you. Often, it will be an opioid medication.
You see OxyContin come onto the market at the end of 1996, and it doesn't really take off as a drug across the states until about 1997. But at that point, its manufacturer, Purdue Pharma, really starts pushing it.
Some patients may be afraid of taking opioids because they're perceived as too strong or addictive. But that is far from actual fact.
Their big selling point, which was actually subsequently proved to be a lie, was that they were safer, they were less addictive than other less strong opioids on the market.
Chris McGreal has been following the opioid epidemic in America for years, and it is a crisis that affects every state in the country. His journey has taken him from rural towns to the corridors of Washington, D.C.
The Centers for Disease Control has a map of where opioid overdoses first started to happen. And it begins as a little red dot in southern West Virginia.
The little red dot sits over a tiny part of the state called Mingo County. In just a matter of years, this rural area became the opioid capital of the US, affecting the lives of thousands of people. Now, states like West Virginia are taking large drug companies to court over their role in America's opioid crisis, which has claimed 400,000 lives. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, who is to blame for America's opioid epidemic?
A few years ago, I met Willis Duncan in his home. It's a wooden cabin in Mingo County. He'd been an electrician on the mines for many, many years. That basically been his career. He's quite frank about the fact that, you know, he had used marijuana and other very low-level drugs, you know, the pain relief that was common on the mines in the 80s and 90s. Because, you know, as he said, you're down in the mines as an electrician, you're on your knees in water. This is absolutely back-breaking work. And then he has an accident, and he goes to the wellness clinic, and he gets prescribed OxyContin because he's got cracked ribs, and that's really when his problems start. He says that he very, very quickly became addicted to those. A couple of years after, his wife, Debbie, she has a hysterectomy, and she's prescribed very high dosage opioids as well. Within a short while, they're both using them, and the medicine cabinet in their bathroom is full of these pills. Debbie declines much faster. Willis describes her. He'd come home sometimes, and she was so addicted to these drugs that he'd find her stopped dead in the middle of the room, like a robot, bent over, unable to move. And then his son Brian, who also works on the mine, starts using them, and he's not entirely sure about how Brian got into them. He thinks it's because they were being passed around on the mines, just, as I say, for kind of routine pain relief. But Brian, before long, is also getting prescriptions from the wellness clinic. So you've got these three members of this family. And of course, they are, by this point, using so many drugs that they're not only getting them from the wellness clinic, they're also having to get them on the black market. The tragedy is that in time, both Debbie and Brian overdose and die. And Willis is left alone. And even then, he says he couldn't get off. He'd lost both of them, and he still couldn't get himself off the drugs. And in the end, it was simply he could no longer afford it. He was spending $1,000 or more a month to buy opioids. If he'd gone out, as he says, and just started using heroin and dealers had been selling him heroin, that would be one thing. He would say to himself, I've only got myself to blame. I took myself down that path. But he thinks that he was essentially conned, that corporate drug dealers and doctors came in and never told him the real dangers of these drugs, and that he was dragged into something that, you know, down a path he would never have gone of his own free will.
The path Willis was dragged down was familiar to a lot of people in Mingo County, and it wasn't long before it caught the attention of the authorities, and in particular, one very determined officer, Sergeant Mike Smith, a West Virginia state policeman who began an undercover investigation.
And I ended up going undercover and was buying drugs, had a different alias and all that.
Mike and Smith comes into the picture in the very early 2000s. He's been involved in tackling drug dealing before. And as he told me, it used to be he'd get in a helicopter and fly over more rural parts of the state and just look down and see where the marijuana was being grown. Or he'd be busting people dealing outside bars. And he said the amazing thing about these opioids was people would happily tell you where they got them. They were getting them from a town called Williamson of about 3,000 people, where doctors were just prescribing them to basically anybody that slapped down the cash.
So he goes there. What happens?
He gets to Williamson and he thinks, well, you know, maybe I'm going to have to do a bit of undercover work here to try and find out what's really going on. And the first place he goes is the Williamson Wellness Clinic, where he finds hundreds of people lined up outside. And he thinks, this is mind-boggling.
The month, it almost looked like a carnival in town. Right. I mean, just people walking everywhere. I mean, it was just blatant.
And he says to himself, well, it can't be that all these drugs are being bought by people here. And indeed, they weren't. So he starts to look at the license plates of the cars, and they're from hundreds of miles away, some of them. They're from Tennessee and Florida and Ohio. And what he realizes is that word has spread that this is the place to come to get your drugs. And that was the start of what became really a nearly decade-long investigation and pursuit of opioid dealing, both corporate and dealing by the medical profession in southern West Virginia.
It's pretty much a cartel. I mean, it was a DTO, drug trafficking organization, in my opinion.
How did the operation out of the Williamson Wellness Center work, Chris?
It's almost by accident that it even gets off the ground. There's a man called Henry Vinson, and Henry Vinson's actually from Williamson. And as he told me, his life's ambition when he was a teenager was to be an undertaker, which, as it turned out, would be appropriate. And he trains in the mortuary business and he becomes an undertaker in Williamson. And the way he did business didn't go down well there. He was arrested for withholding a body because an elderly woman couldn't pay. He was also arrested for misusing public funds. Anyway, he eventually decides he needs to get out of town.
Sounds like he definitely needed to get out of town.
Yes, indeed. So he goes off to Washington, D.C. and works for an undertaker's there. But he realizes that he can make a lot more money on the side as a gay escort. And one thing leads to another. And before long, he's running the biggest gay escort agency in Washington, D.C. And Henry Vinson finds himself doing 4 years in federal prison. When he comes out, he's told by his probation officer that he has to go back to Williamson and that he has to find himself a job and live with his mother. And he finds himself a job with a doctor called Diane Schaefer, who's a family friend, as her clerk. And he realizes that this is very early on, that in the late 90s, that Diane is prescribing very large numbers of opioids. So what he does is he gets an old warehouse that his mother actually owns, and he starts to recruit doctors just to prescribe opioids. He draws in a doctor from Florida who's about to lose her medical license for a very bizarre incident involving her trying to persuade her teenage patients to have sex with her teenage son.
Oh, my God.
Patients come in, they get seen, they pay $150 for an appointment, they get an opioid prescription, and essentially the doctors never want to see them again because that takes time, right? And they could be seeing other patients. And so the way it works is that there's a prescription waiting for them, pre-filled out, waiting to be signed whenever they come in and slap down $150 cash. And that way, these doctors can technically see, in inverted commas, hundreds of patients a day. There is so much money at one point that they can't even close the cash drawers.
And the patients that are going to this warehouse and getting their drugs, if they had turned up to their doctor complaining of the same pain, how would that have been managed properly?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think it's one of the problems at the heart of this. Many doctors really didn't have the information on how to use opioids. with their patients. So there would have been some who would have prescribed in much the same way. The difference is, and this is a really important difference, is that as you become more dependent and addicted on these drugs, you need higher doses just to maintain the equilibrium. At the clinic, at the Williamson Wellness Clinic, essentially your dosage would be increased to massive amounts, no questions asked. I think with many ordinary doctors, they would have asked questions. They would have said, is there a problem? They would have seen the impact of these drugs on their patients. Not all of them. These doctors were being falsely trained that if a person needs more of these drugs, you should give them more, that it's a way of offsetting the pain. The way these drugs work on your body, if you go into withdrawal, they essentially replicate the pain in your body. And so the danger is you take more and more drugs thinking you're fighting pain, whereas actually what you're doing is just feeding addiction.
One of the doctors involved, the one that had been recruited from Florida, she was called Catherine Hoover. What was her role?
So Catherine Hoover, she becomes the biggest prescriber through the 2000s in the Williamson Wellness Clinic.
It was so out of line that there was some days that when we ran Catherine Hoover's DEA number and we put on a spreadsheet and stuff, there was some days that she prescribed to like 400 or 500 people a day. And there's no, I mean, it's just not possible.
She writes so many prescriptions that she is writing more than West Virginia's biggest hospital combined.
And how was she and other doctors benefiting from that?
It was just the cash, really. You know, if you have hundreds, possibly thousands of people going in every day to this clinic and putting down $150 in cash, you can only begin to imagine how much money is being made. Mm. And when finally the clinic is raided, they find millions of dollars lying around in safe deposit boxes, in bank accounts. There is an enormous amount of cash. That tiny little clinic in that tiny little town poured in tens of millions of dollars over those years.
But the Williamson Wellness Center was not the only clinic that had realized big money could be made from the sale of opioid pills. Other pharmacies started popping up all over the county. At one point, drug distributors were shipping more narcotic painkillers to Mingo County per head of population than any other place in the United States.
One of the things that's, you know, we can't quantify, no one can quantify because these pills went so far and wide, is really we don't know how many deaths any of these doctors and pharmacists contributed to. But there's no doubt that there must be blood on their hands. You know, Mike Smith, who was quite angry about this, put it to me. He said, you know, if these had been heroin dealers, they'd have got 20 years to life. And really, that's all they were, that they were dealing in heroin.
In 2009, the FBI and state police raided the Williamson Clinic, arrested doctors, and cut off the opioid pipeline. Henry Vinson, who set up the clinic, agreed to give the government the Williamson Wellness Center building in return for assurance that he would not be prosecuted for whatever criminal activities may have taken place at the Wellness Center. Dr. Diane Schaefer was arrested, admitted to illegally prescribing opioids, and was sentenced to 6 months in federal prison. She has been banned from practicing medicine. Dr. Catherine Hoover left America for the Bahamas. Federal authorities seized her assets and she was stripped of her medical license, but she didn't face charges for issuing excess opioid prescriptions. She has said she did not commit any crimes and has defended the prescriptions as legitimate. Chris, other doctors in the state were arrested too. Did all of this see an end to the problem in West Virginia?
It certainly saw an end to Williamson as you know, the font, shall we say, for more than a decade of pills across that part of the country. Obviously, it didn't do anything to offset the problems of addiction. West Virginia remains the highest, by far the highest, overdose per capita rate in the country.
What were the broader consequences on other people in the state and also on services?
Obviously, you know, an epidemic of this scale in a relatively poor state like West Virginia, you know, places an enormous burden on the state's resources. The number of children taken into care simply became unmanageable, and the state actually had to send children out of state to be able to look after them. We've also got the toll of treatment. Treating people who try to get off these drugs is, you know, long term. It's not something you do in a matter of weeks. law enforcement finds itself kind of battling opioid-related crime. You can go to Inkermit, for instance, which has a volunteer fire brigade. The head of that said to me, he doesn't deal with many fires anymore. He mostly gets called out for people overdosing because the fire engine has a paramedic on board. On top of that, you have the impact on the much broader impact on society. You know, societies that were already struggling are dragged further down economically, which makes them more dependent on state resources or federal resources. One of the kind of stranger side effects is that when I was interviewing a former West Virginia Attorney General about how he became aware of the epidemic, he said it was because he heard that the state prisons couldn't find enough people to work as prison guards because they couldn't find people who could pass a drugs test. So many people had opioids in their system.
Chris, you've told us a story about individual doctors and pharmacists and one county that got sucked into this pill mill. But opioid producers were supplying drugs to millions of people across the states. And now those states are joining together to fight for compensation. The first federal case is due to begin today, which will decide on what could be a comprehensive financial settlement across the country. Who's involved in this case?
The way it works is that there's over 2,000 different plaintiffs in this case. They're everything from small towns like Kermit through to states. But to get this off the ground, there's a test case with two small Ohio counties, which include Cleveland, Ohio, a big city. And it's to test the evidence, essentially. Now, going into this, you've got the drug makers. Now, almost all the drug makers have already settled out of court to avoid any embarrassing public hearing. There's one remains. The second group of people in that case are the drug distributors, who most people in the United States won't have heard of, but they include some of the biggest corporations in the country. And then the third group are the big-name pharmacy chains in the United States. And then after the court has heard a handful or more of these test cases, it will decide the grounds on which all of the other cases should be settled. But what we're expecting to hear is really that big picture. Up until now, the court cases have focused on the drug makers like Johnson & Johnson and Purdue Pharma. This case is really expected to lay out what happened, how all of these companies work together. And that's the core of the case, that this is actually an industry-wide conspiracy. And there is quite a lot of evidence in the behavior of those industries over the years, not least in their use of their huge financial resources for political lobbying, to affect policy, to head off investigations and prosecutions.
This isn't the first time these big companies have been under scrutiny. For years, there have been lots of local lawsuits where pharmaceutical companies have paid cities and states out of court. In August, a judge in Oklahoma found Johnson & Johnson ran a false and dangerous sales campaign that caused addiction and death in the state.
We have proven that Johnson & Johnson built its billion-dollar brand out of greed and on the backs of pain and suffering of innocent people.
Both Purdue Pharma and Johnson & Johnson vigorously deny any wrongdoing. When they settle out of court, is this just a way for them not to admit liability?
These constant and repeated out-of-court settlements are a real problem for a lot of the people who are pressing these cases. The mayor of Huntington, West Virginia, said to me, them being allowed to just simply reach an out-of-court settlement in which they essentially keep, you know, a large part of the profits of the problem that they've caused.
Has this episode changed the way that the drug companies are regulated in America?
I think this is one of the most shocking things about this whole epidemic is I have to conclude that really the problems that made this possible in the first place haven't really been learned. A couple of years ago, the Centers for Disease Control came up with recommendations to limit opioid prescribing. And the industry has fought those tooth and nail very, very strongly. And it has actually used its influence, corporate influence, through lobbying in Congress to get a committee appointed to override those CDC guidelines. So the idea that the lessons have been learned and that the pharmaceutical companies, you know, are desperately trying to avoid something else happening again. I don't think it's true. I think they have done everything they can to avoid a responsibility and accountability. And you can hear it in the language that they use. When they talk about this epidemic, they talk about drug abusers. They say this is a drug abuse epidemic, an opioid abuse epidemic. And the reason for doing that is it blames the person who becomes addicted. It blames the victim, not the pills. And that's been their narrative all along. But these are people like Willis Duncan, who did indeed go on to abuse drugs because he became hooked. But he became hooked because he was following a prescription that he was told by his doctors was safe. And the reason doctors were saying it was safe was because that's what the drug companies were telling them. These drug companies are still not facing up to their responsibility for having created this epidemic.
Chris, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Chris McGreal's book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, is out now. Coming up, Emma Barnett hates her periods, but she hates that women don't feel they can talk about theirs even more. Now, it's that time of the month. Auntie Flo's visiting. Or if you're from Denmark, there are communists in the funhouse. Apparently, there are around 150 ways to say you're on your period. Why is talking directly about it still so taboo? The broadcaster and journalist Emma Barnett says it is high time we remove the stigma around menstruation.
I think because periods come out of our vaginas, we have badged them as dirty. We put them almost in the same box as sexual, despite a period being a perfectly normal bodily process to which we all owe our lives to some healthy semblance of. I think one of the biggest things that has to change is the notion that talking about your period, whether that is at work, whether that's to your other half, whether that's to your children, is something that you shouldn't do. It should be as normal as saying you have a migraine. The stigma needs to be broken because it does hold women back, whether that's health-wise. And in my instance, I didn't know I had endometriosis, which is where tissues like the womb lining that should leave your body don't build up, cause huge amounts of pain, and I didn't know I was effectively sleepwalking into infertility because the disease gets worse. So if I had knowledge and answers about my period and about my life, that would have really helped me in many ways. But it also needs to be broken because the way that periods still deem women as different to men, as lower than men, as more vulnerable, however you want to put it, leaves us in a box that is marked other, and that is not a good box to be in when we're still striving for equality to men. The other myth that has to die is that your period should cost you money. Hopefully in the UK, we will no longer have VAT charged on these products, not just because of those who are poorest in society who would be lifted up by that, but it's a basic human right. But on top of that, can you imagine if men had periods and at the time when they were mandating that soap and toilet roll had to be in all public toilets, do you not think they would have put some sort of basic provision for tampons and sanitary towels? I think they would. The stigma to do with periods has its roots largely in a patriarchal history, and the patriarchal history of most societies does link with religion. Most faiths have laws around what they call religious purity and rules around women when they menstruate. Either they have to be separated from the rest of those in society physically by being put into huts, that still happens in Nepal, or they're not allowed to go to temple, they're not allowed to bury their dead, they're certainly not allowed to share a bed with their other half. The idea of women being dirty on their periods, being impure, that's the word that religious people would probably prefer, is deeply baked within the major faiths in this world. And that is something that has to change. Religious purity laws, I say this as someone who is Jewish, I do not believe have a place in the 21st century. Feminists themselves have shied away from this subject. And in some ways, I understand that because they didn't wish for women to seem vulnerable or different or less than. But I would argue that the moment has come for us to change that. And a woman who is honest about her flow is not a woman to be messed with.
That was Emma Barnett. Her book, Period, is out now. Thanks to her and to Chris McGreal. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.